Los Angeles isn't receiving enough vaccines from the federal government to meet our daily capacity. Case in point, this week, we are only allocated about 60,000 vaccine doses. That's about 60% less than what we are capable today of delivering. So as soon as we get more, we will do much more and protect so many more lives, restart our economy, reopen our schools. And I've said this to our state partners, and I'll say it to our federal leaders, give us the supply and we can vaccinate everyone by July.
Mayor Eric Garcetti yesterday addressing vaccine shortages. He also said the winter storms battering most of the country caused distribution delays here. As a result, around vaccine appointments for 12,000 people here in LA were postponed. Garcetti's target of vaccinating everyone by midsummer means life may finally start to return to some semblance of normal. But how should our behavior change once we're vaccinated? Should we throw our masks off and live like we used to? And even if the vaccines prevent a severe COVID infection, how well do they keep the virus from spreading? Researchers are starting to get some answers to that last question, and the data for at least one of the vaccines looks promising. Here to discuss this is Erin Garcia de Jesus. She has a PhD in microbiology and writes for Science News Magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you. These results are coming out of Israel, and that country is leading the world in distributing the vaccine. I believe around 40% of the population there is now vaccinated. Why has Israel been so successful in vaccinating its population?
I think a lot of that probably has to do with policy, which I am not an expert in. But, I mean, they rolled things out quickly and have made it a priority to get the vaccine to people over the age of 60. And it's been great to see some of the results that are coming out of Israel.
And they're mainly using the Pfizer vaccine. I understand that they actually struck a deal with Pfizer that in exchange for a large supply, that Pfizer would be able to get some of the data. And so what kind of data is Pfizer getting and what kind of data is emerging from Israel?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of interesting things that are coming out of Israel. The one that I am most familiar with is some data showing that the Pfizer's vaccine might actually reduce coronavirus transmission, and that's through reducing the amount of virus that people actually carry in their bodies, which is called viral load. So there's some studies hinting that that the vaccine might decrease the amount of virus that people carry if they happen to get infected. And because they have less virus in their bodies, they're probably less likely to transmit the virus on to another person.
Oh, so that's interesting. So that's how it is transmitted. It's the level of viral load. So if you reduce that, you have a reduced level of transmission. I suppose that makes sense. How does that work with people who are infected but don't show symptoms?
You mean people who have been vaccinated who don't show symptoms, or people in general?
Who have not been vaccinated, because they're just people in general, people who are asymptomatic, who have not received the vaccine. Would they have a lower viral load and therefore be less likely to transmit, or no?
Not necessarily. I know that there are some people who have no symptoms but tend to have high viral loads. So you can't always necessarily say that viral load completely relates to whether you're going to be have symptoms or not. But depending on your what viral load you do have, whether you have symptoms or not, that studies have shown that that will indicate whether that is a that can better represent like whether you might be infectious or not.
So this study about vaccinating people who have been vaccinated and the fact that they are less likely to transmit the virus, do they have a percentage for the reduction in transmission?
They don't have a percentage. So I did talk to one researcher who did some back of the envelope calculations and found that it's on the mark of about 10 to 15% less likely to transmit the virus. But it's also important to note that these studies were done only after people had gotten one dose of the vaccine. So the Pfizer's vaccine, you know, it's two doses. You ideally would need two doses to get the full level of protection. So the studies was done after people had only gotten the one shot. And so he was saying that it's, you would expect that maybe after the second shot, you might see that reduction increase, but we don't have that data yet. So it's hard to say whether that would necessarily be the case.
Why don't we have that data? And why did we not have that data before the vaccines were approved?
I mean, these things take time. These vaccines were really only started to roll out to the larger population in December and, you know, at the beginning of this year. So it takes time to be able to analyze the data that you get from people and see what is happening in the real world. And part of the reason we didn't get much of that information from clinical trials goes back to the point that this data, this is a harder question to answer than compared with, does the vaccine stop symptoms? I mean, you can outwardly see when somebody gets sick with COVID-19, you know, you have outward symptoms. It's harder to tell whether somebody is transmitting the virus to somebody else, or if they don't have symptoms, whether they're infected or not. You have to monitor a lot of people for that. So it's just, these studies take time, and some questions are harder to answer than others.
But to conclude,
we're starting to get hints.
Yeah. So preliminary information shows that the vaccine is effective in reducing the transmission, even if
at least
people who are vaccinated just with one shot.
Right. So this is these studies, it's a proxy. So they're looking at viral load as a proxy for whether that person might be contagious or not. So it's a less of a direct relationship, which makes it more of a preliminary hint that this might be the case. Scientists need to do a little bit more probing to figure out and confirm that that actually is the case, but it is a very promising hint in that direction.
And this is only the Pfizer vaccine that we're talking about. No data yet on Moderna or any of the other ones?
Not for this particular question on the viral load side of things for Moderna. There was some data out of Moderna's clinical trial that they submitted to the FDA back in December, showing that people who had gotten vaccinated with Moderna shot were less likely to get infected in general. And again, that is also preliminary data, but it suggests that, I mean, if you're not getting infected in the first place, you're not going to pass the virus on to somebody else. So it is another hopeful hint that these vaccines are going to help control the transmission as well.
So in the short run, for now, people who have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated, shouldn't necessarily throw their masks away and live like they did.
Right. I mean, we're waiting for more information. We know that masks work. We're getting some hints that the vaccines are going to protect us in these very important ways. So there's a light at the end of the tunnel that hopefully some studies may give out results in the next few weeks, I've heard some scientists say. So, we're eagerly awaiting that data. And, you know, wearing a mask is important for the time being. We are getting promising hints for now. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Erin Garcia de Jesus, staff writer for Science News Magazine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why has California decided that stores can reopen but museums can't? And what is that doing to smaller institutions who've been closed now for almost a year? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you want to browse stores and try on shoes, well, the malls are open. Hair and nail salons also open. Tattoo parlors open. But what you can't do is go to an indoor art museum. When Governor Gavin Newsom lifted parts of the stay-at-home order last month, retailers and personal services could reopen, but not museums. And so that's left an odd scenario where the gift shop at LACMA is open, but the museum itself is not. We're going to talk about how the shutdown is affecting museums now with three guests. Robin Pogrebin is culture reporter for The New York Times, and she's been covering this story. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. And also joining us is Keisha Dumas-Heath. She's the executive director of the Museum of African American Art in Baldwin Hills. Hi, Keisha.
Hi.
And also joining us, Justin Jampol. He's executive director and founder of the Venda Museum. That's a museum dedicated to the Cold War in Culver City. Hi there, Justin.
Hey, Madeline.
Let's begin with you, Robin, and give us the reasoning from the state as to why they won't let museums reopen.
So basically, the state has this rationale that they are concerned, A, about museums drawing people from out of state, and also them being places where the virus could spread. What these museums counter is that they actually are, they have a lot of square footage, which would allow for distancing. And they've also made extensive preparations to be kind of COVID safe in terms of putting marks on the floor where people would have to stand, making sure people register when they come in, and also just having, you know, huge elevators and circulation patterns that would guard against it. As you can probably imagine, some of these retail operations that are open are considerably more contained in space.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, Keisha, you are in a particularly ironic position in that your museum is actually located in a mall, which is open, but your museum is not. So how can you explain that?
That's true. I don't know. I don't know how close the state is to being able to explain it. I think some of the guidelines may not have taken into consideration the possibility of shared spaces and kind of hybrid situations like ours. So the Museum of African American Art is actually located on the third floor of Macy's in the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall. We all shut down initially in March 2020. Macy's did reopen in June 2020. And the museum, of course, according to the mandates at the state and county levels, the museum has been required to stay closed despite being in the Macy's. And we are also connected to the mall itself, which is also now reopened. So it is quite ironic.
It is. And so do you have people coming up to your doors and who happen to be shopping and want to check it out and they can't?
We actually do. The museum was contacted some months ago by the new store manager there at Macy's, who's great. And she actually contacted me directly to say that there were people in the store who were looking for the museum and wondering why it was not open and when it would reopen.
Justin, yours is a freestanding museum, but also shut down. How have you been able to stay afloat?
Well, hearing the stories like I just heard is so frustrating because museums are set up precisely to engage with visitors. We're not in the business of trying to sell things. We are about managing the flow of people, ensuring safety. And museums are exactly the kinds of organizations set up, much more than a mall would be. So I think it should be the other way around. The museum should be open and the mall should be closed. But I think it underscores something larger at play here, which is that arts and culture is often seen as a luxury or under the umbrella of entertainment. Couldn't be farther from the truth. And if anything, the last year has shown me what a robust organization nonprofits and museums are. We come together. Our lot has been turned into a place for testing, for distributing PPE. And so I think we need to start thinking more about arts and cultural institutions and the important role that we have in the community.
Right. And so I guess you don't have the same kind of power, lobbying power, as retail, big retail stores or film studios.
No.
Production houses, things like that, which have been open.
No. And, you know, it also means that we don't have the tools that for-profits have, both politically, but also financially, which is, I think, one of the big stories in arts and culture, that, a lot of for-profits can have lines of credit and other means to get through a period like this. Nonprofits don't. For-profit banks don't understand non-culture, you know, nonprofits like ours. And I think we're all in the same boat in that. And it's not like we have the same sort of lifeline. So the irony is we are a group of people that I think need the help the most, and we get it the least.
Robin, art galleries are open.
That's because they are considered commerce, so they fall into that category. And it also bears mentioning, Madeline, to your first question as to the rationale that the state gives, is that people will spend too much time in these museums, and also this out-of-state argument that they will draw people from out-of-state. In fact, you know, were the state to kind of do its homework, they would find that actually museums get, I think, 70 to 80% is of their visitorship from the is local, you know, within the county. And also that people, visitors typically spend less than 20 minutes in exhibitions. So actually those arguments don't hold water. And a lot of what you hear from museums that I've spoken to is that when you see them reopening in places like New York, in Houston, and around the rest of the country, I mean, LA is unique in not having reopened. You find that it's just because, you know, obviously museums have been able to make the case to government that they matter, that people need this kind of respite and cultural sort of stimulation in a time when they're locked down. And actually these museums in, could really in California be a real antidote to the pandemic right now.
Right. And they do know how to do timed entry. A lot of museums have them. You have to make a reservation. They usher you through. You can only spend a certain in the very popular exhibitions. You can only spend a certain amount of time. I remember the Kusama exhibition. That was really fast. You had to move through very quickly.
That's right.
And so they do have experience.
Yeah, I mean, Lackman talks about how they have guards, they require masks, they would do temperature checks. They even have two questionnaires you would fill out, one when you made a reservation to get a ticket and two when you arrived. So there would be really rigorous screening. And all museums are asking to do is right now they're in this purple tier of categorization. They want to move into the red, which would then allow them to be open at 25% capacity. It would not be full capacity, wouldn't even be half. So it really seems kind of a minimal step to take. And I think there's just not enough pressure to bear, I guess, on the government to make it happen, at least right now.
Keisha, you did testify before the state legislature. And how was their reception to your argument that you should be allowed to reopen?
I did testify, and I thought my testimony was well received in the hearing. At the time that I was giving the testimony, as well as afterwards, people have seen the video of it, and one of the committee members shared it with folks, and I've just been really encouraged by the really positive response that we have received from other museums and art centers across the state.
But yet they haven't changed the rules.
Not yet. We're still hoping. We are still, you know, speaking out and really advocating in that direction. We'll have to hang in there and see what impact that it will have.
Justin, why don't museums have a stronger lobbying force? Robin just mentioned that in other cities, they seem to be more persuasive.
I think we're much less organized than other places are. That was underscored by an event we hosted last month with 24 different organizations, nonprofit museums around Southern California to talk about this. You know, that we are ready and willing to open up in the most safe and reasonable and appropriate way. Why aren't we getting a kind of attention that I think we deserve? So where we are right now is trying to develop protocols to ensure the county and the state that we're ready to do this. But I think as the point has been made, we're exactly the group to do it. And the fact is, a lot of museums, including ours, are cavernous. They're huge. They're not small little shops. In fact, when airflow and sort of air capacity is a big part of transmission, these are the kinds of organizations that you want to be in. And, you know, in a time when mental health is so important as well, you know, other organizations are really starting to wake up to the need to organize together. So I'm hopeful that there will be some movement, but we'll see.
Hmm. And are you able to survive financially? Shut down for what, almost a year?
It's crazy. I mean, the thing that I've seen is that those who are closest to the organization are the most responsive, and thank goodness for that. And that's how so many of us are surviving. But what I've seen, I've talked to my colleagues as well. And one of the things that's been really harmed arts and culture institutions in Southern California is the foundations that usually support arts and culture. Many of them have redirected or redeployed funding for the here and the now need, but I don't think they often know the ripple effect that it has. It means that in a time when we need the support the most, there's the least amount of funding out there. Now, the Getty and some others have stepped up in a big way, which is great, and that's hopeful. But it's really what we're worried about is not only the here and now, but the ripple effect in a year or two, because fundraising is all about your pipeline, and the pipeline has been absolutely stopped for this entire year. So, you know, even as we come out of this and people can come back in the museum again, the problems don't stop there.
Keisha, what about you? How are you surviving financially?
So we have been somewhat fortunate in that since the time of our closure, we actually were able to receive a CARES recovery grant through California Humanities. And we also were able to apply for a couple of corporate grants, not foundation funding, but corporate grants that that we did receive as well. So that was really a great shot in the arm for us. And I will say also that we found that our members and our supporters have really, really been sticking with us through this time. We've had folks continue with their memberships. We've had folks continue with, you know, making individual donations. So we are really feeling encouraged by that and have some hope, you know, for the future that we will be able to make it through this time. But still, we would like to reopen as soon as possible. We, you know, have found that not being able to host events as we usually would has an impact, of course, on our memberships and on our donations and on our gift shop sales, of course. So,
yeah. Robin, are the bigger institutions, the Gettys, the LACMAs, are they able to weather this for a while better than the smaller museums and that, you know, like these two that we're talking about?
It is certainly true that the larger ones have more of a cushion in terms of their donor base, their boards, and the funding kind of opportunities they're tapped into in terms of major foundations and corporations. But it bears saying that they are suffering too when you have no revenue coming in from visitors. And also fundraising is very much circumscribed by this. You can't have your usual galas and events and other public programs. That's why we've seen layoffs and furloughs across the country. This is a sector that is hurting too. And to this ripple effect that, that Justin mentioned, I think it's really true that that affects all the commerce that's around the museum and other such events. The California Museums Association has estimated that it's costing institutions $22 million a day, and that total estimated revenue losses for 2020 are more than $5 billion, and that's including science centers and zoos and aquariums. So this is not a nominal amount of loss, and I think the impact is significant.
Yeah, so much so that some museums, like the Brooklyn Museum, are selling works of art.
Well, that is, you know, a whole other can of worms that's going on. Even the Met just announced a story that I did earlier this week that they are considering what's called deaccessioning, selling certain items in order to essentially pay the bills. And the only reason they're able to do that is because the Association of Museum of Art Directors relaxed the rules so that usually you can only sell art to buy more art. Now they said for 2 years you can sell art to pay for care of the collection. And museums are taking advantage of that because they feel like they have to. Even a place as big and solid as the Met is projecting a $150 million deficit. And so this is obviously very controversial, a very sensitive subject. Museums do sell all the time routinely to kind of cull their collections, but they don't do it to pay operating costs. And that is a really sensitive point on which there are very different opinions. And it's going to cause, I think, a lot of controversy in the field.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for coming on today and talking about this issue, important issue.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great.
Definitely. That was Robin Pogrebin. She is cultural reporter for The New York Times. Keisha Dumas Heath is executive director of the Museum of African American Art in Baldwin Hills. And Justin Jumpel is executive director and founder of the Venda Museum in Culver City. Yep, we will have your Friday film reviews.
The problem with this movie is that Ross Ulbricht is this 25-year-old libertarian edgelord, and you have to listen to him talk about that the whole time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. While we wait for museums to open, you can still see a movie at home. So let's review a few new releases. Joining me to do just that is Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Madeline.
And also Sean Edwards, film critic and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you. Well, our first film today is called Silk Road, and it's about Ross Ulbricht's creation of the dark web marketplace known as Silk Road. Ross Ulbricht is now serving a life sentence, and this movie stars Nick Robinson as Ulbricht. It's directed by Tiller Russell, and here's a bit from the trailer.
I've always wanted to change the world.
How?
Amazon for drugs.
But you can't buy drugs on the internet.
What if you could? Using Bitcoin. I just made 75 grand in the last 90 minutes, babe. This guy's the first millennial gangster.
Ooh, Katie. All right. So this is based on a true story. And how did you find it?
You know, the problem with this movie is that Ross Ulbricht is this, you know, 25-year-old libertarian edgelord. And you have to listen to him talk about that the whole time. And you're like, oh, my God, I have to listen to this guy talk about his, like, you know, it's just so funny. He's like in a bar spouting off about these, you know, libertarian ideology. You know, you're just like, oh, my God, I have to listen to this guy. This is the last guy I want to listen to for 2 hours.
Oh, gosh. So
I had a little bit of a hard time getting into it. And, you know, some of the dialogue is pretty laughable. It felt very dated. You know, it does take place in, like, you know, 2010, 2013. But it felt very dated for something that was supposed to be kind of like a cutting edge tech thriller. You know, it's based on a article that was in Rolling Stone in 2014 by David Kushner. And they've sort of invented this or beefed up the role of this DEA agent who actually went to prison for stealing Bitcoin during the investigation. And so they've turned him into this much bigger character. So it's this cat and mouse game between this old school DEA agent played by Jason Clark. And it's kind of a weird movie. I felt like I was like, is this movie trying to lionize Ross Ulbricht? I mean, Silk Road really went to a bad place, you know, mm-hmm. resulting in some violence and deaths. And Ross Ulbricht was like ordering hits on people via the website. So,
yeah.
You know, it's just weird. You can't quite tell, you know, you feel like the film is kind of trying to take an objective stance on him, but you can tell that it's kind of buying into everything he kind of wants to say.
Sean, what did you think?
No, I actually agree mostly with everything Katie just said, but I also feel that in the hands of a more capable director and a better writer, I mean, Silk Road could have been every bit as engaging as The Social Network, but it wasn't. And what you get is sort of like surface level knowledge with generic cinematic execution, but the cast is just talented enough to where it makes you feel like you're watching a guilty pleasure movie as opposed to something that could have been gripping and hard hitting and an examination of something that's really important and really went to a dark, dark place on the dark web. There's mm-hmm. a much better movie here if they didn't focus so much on steering away from the things that actually happened to make this more of a movie with the fictional elements.
All right. Our next film is called Blithe Spirit. It's a film adaptation of a 1941 play by Noel Coward about a struggling writer desperate for inspiration. So he contacts a psychic who's played by Judi Dench to help sort things out.
I'd like you to conduct a seance at my home.
This Thursday. The moon is full and we must harness its power.
Perfect.
Is there anyone on the other side that you think of?
Elvira, his dead ex-wife.
Elvira?
Hello?
You're dead.
I haven't the foggiest idea how to send her back.
You're in trouble now.
Okay, Sean, so it's wife versus wife with the hapless screenwriter in the middle?
Yeah, that's right. He's tormented by the ghost of his jealous first wife. And on paper, yeah, this all seems pretty funny and pretty comedic, but the end result was pretty stale, very unfunny, spiritless, and not a very good version of the original, which was directed by, you know, David Lean back in 1945. But the cast is incredible. I mean, you talk about an A-list cast. It's in capable hands when it comes to the actors. They just did not have a lot to work with. But the biggest problem with the film is overall, it just felt very dated, and they didn't do enough to make it contemporary funny enough.
Katie, Dan Stevens stars. How did he do?
Yeah, I completely agree with Sean on his points. And yes, the cast is amazing. It's Dan Stevens, Isla Fisher, and Leslie Mann. And they are such capable comedians, and they're wacky and funny, but this movie doesn't push them. And we've all seen them do, you know, much funnier, much wackier, bigger characters. And so I just felt like we've seen these people, like, let them go, you know, like these are some high performance creatures that you've got, you know, you let them loose. And it sort of felt a little bit like it didn't push the material. It didn't push the actors. And so it doesn't really quite work. My favorite thing about the film, though, is the production design by John Paul Kelly. It is totally amazing. And it's shot at an estate in Surrey called Jaldwyns, where they shot some Agatha Christie Poirot mysteries, and like they've just done amazing things with the interiors. So that was what I was really focused on.
Moving on to a documentary that seems to be quite the opposite. It's called Truth to Power. It's about the hard rock band System of a Down and their political activism, specifically the band's lead singer, Serge Tankian. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Armenian hard rockers System of a Down are political and popular.
Calling on the world to recognize the forgotten Armenian genocide of 1915, but also taking on Armenia's own government.
The people are out there tired of a corrupt regime and they want it to change.
It's our responsibility to tell you these things and to rock you at the same time.
All right, Katie, give us the background on this band and what they're all about.
Yeah, so System of a Down are actually L.A. hometown heroes. They are from the Armenian community right here in L.A., and there's some really fun footage and exploration of Little Armenia, where Serge Tankian grew up, and it happens to be my old neighborhood, so that was a treat to see. And they became, super popular in, like, 98, 2000, 2001. They were also firebrands for controversy because Serge Tankian was very outspoken about his political beliefs. And they have become this really important figure in the Armenian diaspora, speaking out about the corruption there, speaking out about the recognition of the Armenian genocide. They pushed Dennis Hastert to vote on the Armenian genocide recognition. And then the film sort of coalesces around this concert that they had in 2015, where Tankian was speaking from the heart, very impassioned about, you know, standing up to the corruption of the government there. And a couple of years later, the member of parliament who launched a peaceful revolution there, he really cited Tankian's words at that concert as being an inspiration for him to start this revolution. He was like, if System of a Down can get 50,000 people in the square in Yerevan, like I can, you know, get 50,000 people to have a revolution. So It's a pretty standard rock doc, but it's really inspiring. And he's just a really cool guy to get to know a little bit more about.
Sean, what did you think?
I actually liked it. I was amazed at the ability of the filmmakers to pack a lot of information in only 79 minutes. I also like the fact that it's a rock doc that's not a rock doc. I like the fact that they focused on his social activism and the way it's structured. They give you just enough about the origins of the band and him growing up to where you didn't have to be a fan of System of a Down in order to enjoy where this band came from, how they progressed, how they became famous, and how they morphed into much more than a band. I mean, really, at first glance, it's not really a documentary per se, but it's sort of like a new style of journalism where he's allowed to talk about what led to his convictions and what led to his fight in a way that's very palatable, but also very, very cinematic. I mean, it's not like it's the most like groundbreaking documentary ever, but it's structured and it's just simple enough to where a lot of people can get an understanding of the story and understand the cause. And I thought the documentary was very effective in doing that.
All right, great. So something good to watch, finally.
Yes.
All right, let's finish up with a new film called I Care a Lot, starring Rosamund Pike. She's a thieving legal guardian who has a very sharp, blunt-cut hairstyle, and she preys on older people. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Marla Grayson, you've had amazing success. What's your secret?
There is no secret, Peter.
She forces them into the home, auctions off their house,
and uses the proceeds to pay herself.
Because caring is my job.
Oh, you're in trouble now.
Okay, Sean, what's happening?
Yeah, what's happening is, like you mentioned, Rosamund Pike, she's an overly ambitious legal guardian who makes her living by targeting vulnerable elders, and she hustles them into nursing homes and then fleeces them of their remaining like worldly possessions like their house, jewelry, and money. Just so happens she targets a lady by the name of Jennifer, played by the wonderful Diane Weiss, who just so happens to have a mysterious connection to an alleged mobster played by Peter Dinklage. And of course, some unexpected things unfold at that point. I really love the setup. I really love the subject matter. That in many ways in real life, this guardianship issue is a lot crazier than actually portrayed in the movie. But Rosamund Pike is a favorite of mine. I love her as an actress. She's great in the role. Peter Dinklage is always awesome and amazing. It's not the perfect film. There are some potholes, but they're easily fillable so that you can enjoy the ride. I didn't necessarily like the way that it ended, but I did like the way that it played out. It sputters at moments because I think they try to be too cute as they sort of mix elements of a crime drama in this whole dark comedy elements that exist within the film. But it works well enough, thankfully, to Rosamund Pike and Peter Dinklage, who provide the strength of the film.
Yeah, they're great. And she was great in Gone Girl. Katie, is she Gone Girl times 100 in this?
Totally. She is, you know, she takes that sociopathic character and kind of turns it up to 11 in this performance. I mean, she's totally unmatched in this kind of icy, you know, sociopathic woman role. And I thought she was just amazing in this, just the way she sort of moves her face in these very subtle expressions that you can tell are she's kind of acting as she's acting. And she's just amazing. And I think she's really great in this. I agree that the film is kind of uneven. And to me, it felt, you know, it's this dark comedy, crime, drama, highly stylized, lots of needle drops, you know, songs, you know, it's kind of fast paced. And there's a lot of techno music and style and clothes and all of these things. And I don't know if I just like wasn't in the right mood for it, but it was so heavily ironic and sort of dark that I was like, this just wasn't the vibe for me, I guess. Hmm. I was just kind of like, it was, and the ending, it's hard because you're watching bad people do bad things to other people and you don't know who to root for. So you kind of lose investment in the characters because you don't want to root for her and you don't want to root for him, but you like don't know who to root for. So I kind of lost a little interest in it because I was like, I don't know who I want to prevail at the end of this. And so I felt like kind of lost like who we're supposed to be like attached to in this
film.
Don't
you want to root for Diane Weiss? I mean, always.
Yes, because she kind of falls. I was rooting for Diane Weiss, and then she kind of, you know, disappears from the film until you're like, wait, bring Diane back.
All right. Two possibilities for this weekend. I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
Okay.
Watch Nomadland. It's on Hulu this weekend.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. Cool. Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. And Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you
very much.
Cooking with Evan. Evan Kleinman has some ideas for what to do with all those oranges and lemons in season now. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, one of the best things about winter here in Southern California is oranges, lemons, all kinds of citrus. We're going to talk about that now with Evan Kleinman, because she's going to tell us what to do with all of this citrus that we have right now. She's host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, it's not just oranges and lemons.
No,
there's a cornucopia of citrus.
There is a cornucopia of citrus, and it's like every group has different varieties. So lemons, there are many different varieties of lemons, from Eureka, the standard large lemon with the thicker peel, to Meyer lemons, which we're so blessed to have in abundance here in Southern California. Then we have all different kinds of limes, all different kinds of oranges, from Navels to Valencias to those incredible Caraquera oranges.
What are Caraquera oranges?
The Caraquera oranges are those huge oranges that seem like they're a mix between an orange and a grapefruit.
Mm-hmm.
They're delicious, and they're just dense with juice, and the color somehow is so beautiful.
Yeah, I know. I was shocked when I opened one of those, in a good way. Also, I just discovered a mandalo.
Oh, a mandalo? What is that?
Yeah, it's a mix between a pomelo and a mandarin orange.
Oh my goodness. I've never heard
of it. Look, here I am surprising you.
Oh, that is just fabulous. And what a great name.
So where do we get all this citrus? I know farmers markets, right? But do we dare just get supermarket citrus?
I mean, of course you can get it from the supermarket. But, you know, what I hope is that through these conversations, when I talk about the farmers market with you, is that even if one or two people hearing me today will go and they've never been before, that's like my dream. Because particularly with fruit, the difference between fruit at a supermarket and fruit at the farmer's market is enormous. And even with something like citrus, which you think, oh, well, an orange is an orange is an orange. That's not true. How many times have you bought an orange with such great hopes, and you start to peel it and you see that dryness, and you just get so disappointed? Why not buy it from... It's depressing. And you know, these days, an orange can change your mood totally.
It certainly can, especially when you get one of those crazy ones you just talked about, the Caraquera or the mandalo.
Yeah, or even just a great navel orange. Or I have a giant blood orange tree in my front yard. So right now, despite the plunder from the people walking by my front yard, I still have so many. And it's just wonderful. I love them.
I like a little bit of blood orange with seltzer.
Oh, that sounds really wonderful. They're also really incredible in smoothies if you just throw the whole fruit in, because there's something about a blood orange peel. It's much less bitter than regular citrus peels, and it adds a ton of flavor to your smoothie.
Well, you have brought a couple of recipes, too, that involve citrus.
Yeah. So I brought two recipes. One is a salad from Yotam Ottolenghi, and one is dessert. The thing about the Yotam Ottolenghi salad, which is his famed three citrus salad from his restaurant and cookbook Nopi, is that it also includes chicories, or radicchio, as many of us know it, which is also in season right now at the markets and is of a gorgeousness and variety of color that just would blow your mind. So in this recipe, you're combining oranges, two oranges. So I would do one navel and one blood, a pink grapefruit, a pomelo, and then with radicchio, a couple different kinds. And then, so you have this gorgeousness on the plate, right? All those colors and textures. And then his genius, of course, is what he calls an almond salsa. And it's a dressing with almonds and spicy chili, candied ginger, coriander seed, fennel seed, sherry vinegar, olive oil. So it's spicy and spiced and delicious.
That sounds incredible. And it almost sounds like dessert because you have that candied ginger in there.
Yeah, but then you have that, like I use jalapenos, so it's not too spicy. You have, you know, the chili pepper, and then you have the almonds, which gives you this great sort of hit of nutty protein.
Mm, sounds so good. So that'll be on our website, quesodoblillo.com. Dessert?
Dessert is a citrus cake, and I am very partial to tea cakes, things that you might have a slice in the morning, or you have one mid-afternoon, something you might want to have with a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, things that are very lightly iced, if they're iced at all. And years ago in one of my cookbooks, I wrote a recipe for a cake that had citrus that you boil. So I was just poking around looking for a different recipe that wasn't mine. And I found one that was really similar, but looked really interesting and is made with almonds instead of flour. So it's gluten-free. And this is called Eugenia's Citrus Cake. Eugenia is a friend of mine who lives in Rome. And Elizabeth Minkili published this recipe on her blog. And it's just marvelous because the main technique here is that you are boiling two oranges and a lemon until they're absolutely soft. And then you puree them, and that becomes your liquid for the recipe. And because you have the whole fruit, you get incredible texture and so much flavor.
Mm. So peel and seeds, pith, everything, all of it?
Yeah, you boil them, and then when they're completely soft, you take them out, and you let them cool so you can touch them, and then you cut them in half and you take out the pits. And so once those little pits or pips are gone, then you puree it. And then you just mix it all up. You can do it all in a bowl with the ground almonds, eggs, a bit of sugar, and some baking powder, and throw it in a pan and bake it. And you get this, like, dense, moist, really aromatic cake, the kind that's even better the second day.
That sounds incredibly delicious. And that's kind of a thing that I would just eat all day long. I mean, you mentioned it could
Me
be
too.
For morning, afternoon, evening. I would just keep eating it.
Yeah, just slice it off little by little. At the end of the day, you say to yourself, oh my.
Oh my, I ate the whole thing. What do you do if you have too much citrus? Like, I have to say, I have a lot of citrus that is getting a little wrinkly.
Well, if you have mature trees on your property and they're really, and you really need to clear them off, and you would like to donate some of the citrus, the best thing you could do is call Food Forward, the organization that is now huge and repurposes millions of pounds of fruit and veg every year, taking from abundance and giving to those in need. But they still do what they started with, which was gleaning household citrus trees in Southern California.
Hmm.
Okay. And you can also just pick, put out in boxes in front of your house, and they'll be gone, I promise you.
But what if they're not in the best of shape? Like, they've been sitting on your counter for a while and you want to do something with them, you don't want to throw them away. What would you recommend?
If they're not fermented when you cut them open, I would just juice them all and freeze the juice.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And again, put it in my seltzer. What am I thinking?
Yes, and then with your seltzer, you could make yourself some oleosaccharum if the peels aren't super wrinkly and dry. This is the magic elixir that bartenders use, and it's made simply by zesting citrus. So let's say you have an orange. And I use a peeler. So you want to peel off the peel without getting any of the white pith. And then you just mix it up, like mush it with the back of a spoon or in a mortar and pestle with sugar. And you just leave it. And you let the sugar pull out the essential oils that are in the skin of the citrus, and you end up with something that is the most fragrant and highly flavored extract of an essential oil for eating that you could have.
Oh, Evan, you've done it again. I'm salivating onto my microphone.
Good, then my job is done.
Okay, so all the recipes are on our website at kcrw.com. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. Always a pleasure.
Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Gosh, I have to wipe off my microphone now. That's kind of gross. Well, that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you Monday.